There is no way that we will allow Israeli ships to pass through. The Jews are threatening war. We tell them hello and welcome. We are ready for war. But there is no way we will give up our rights to the Gulf of Aqaba.
The chief of staff of the Israeli army, General Yitzhak Rabin, called on Foreign Minister Abba Eban to find a diplomatic solution to the issue, because Israel was not ready for war as it should be. On May the 25th, 1967, Eban went to the United States to know the U.S.'s opinion about their new problem.
I've been asked by my government to explore what these governments intend to do in order to reopen this international waterway to
what
a situation
do you want
of law.
What the United States to do, sir?
Well, I've come here really to find out what the United States intends to do.
Lyndon B. Johnson, then president of the United States, told Eban that he did not want Israel to start a war. During this meeting, Johnson read part of the secret document to Eban. The document stated that Israel will not be alone unless it decides to go alone. The Soviet Union said the same words to Egypt and urged them not to start a war. In practice, however, Egypt did start the war by closing the Strait of Tiran to Israel. The commanders in the Egyptian war room warned that if they wanted to wait for the first attack would be crippling for Egypt, and the chief of staff commented that if they allowed Israelis to carry out the first attack, they would only fight Israel. But if Egyptians started the attack, in addition to Israel, they must also fight the United States. In the same days, Hussein bin Talal, king of Jordan, visited Abdel Nasser and assured him that he was still disgusted with Israel and ready for a possible war and would help Egypt in the war against Israel. Hussein and Nasser signed a bilateral defense agreement, and Hussein practically ordered his army at the behest of Egypt. The situation became difficult for Israel. Egypt from the south, Jordan from the east, and Syria from the north were ready to attack Israel. Levi Eshkol was in crisis and wanted to know whether or not the United States had any plans to open the Strait of Tiran. But the United States was trapped in the purgatory of Vietnam War and had no patience for new troubles in the Middle East. Eshkol was disappointed with the U.S. support and, in consultation with his new defense minister, General Moshe Dayan, chose June the 5th to attack Egypt. At 7 o'clock in the morning, 180 Israeli fighters flew towards Egypt, and only 12 of them remained to defend the Israeli airspace. Forty-five minutes later, the runways of the Egyptian military airports were bombed and all the Egyptian fighters were targeted by Israeli rockets on the ground without even having a chance to start their engines. The Egyptian Air Force was completely destroyed. The Syrian and Jordanian air forces were also hit by these surprise attacks. Sinai Desert, Egyptian tanks were three times more than Israeli tanks, but there was no air cover for the Egyptian ground forces. The Egyptians had no choice but to withdraw. Egypt's defense minister, General Amr, ordered the withdrawal of their forces from the Sinai Desert. But there was no plan to retreat. As a consequence, Egyptian forces went towards the Suez Canal without any specific plan. Israeli fighters also took advantage of this opportunity and destroyed the Egyptian forces. This unplanned retreat damaged the Egyptian army. Told Jordanians that they would not be in danger if they did not intervene in this war. At 10:30, Jerusalem al-Quds was hit by Jordanian artillery shells. The Jordanian attack was unsuccessful, and the resistance of King Hussein's forces in the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds did not last more than 10 hours. Jordan had the control of the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds and the West Bank, but after the war, lost the control to Israel. It was Syria's turn after Jordan and Egypt. Israeli binoculars had control of the heights bordering Israel and Syria. After 12 hours of intense fighting, Israel captured the Golan Heights. The Soviet Union had already started a war with a false news. When the Soviet Union witnessed Israel attacking its communist ally, Syria, it gave an ultimatum to Israel's supporter, the United States, announcing that it was seeking military support for Syria. This was not just a bluff. Ukrainian jet fighters were ready by the order of the Soviet Union. The Soviet-American Cold War tension reached one of its most complicated moments. Lyndon B. Johnson and his colleagues had a meeting at the White House to find an answer to the Soviet ultimatum. He wrote to Kremlin that he would use every opportunity to stop the Israeli war machine, but in practice, instead of calling the Israeli prime minister in a formal action, he told the U.S. representative to the U.N. to talk to the Israeli representative. The U.S. envoy saw the Israeli representative at the lobby and gave him the message.
United States Ambassador Goldbeck asked me to come out into the lobby and to say to me, you must immediately announce that the fighting is over.
But this was not within the power of the Israeli ambassador to the U.N. The Israeli representative talked to Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Eben about the issue. Eben immediately called Eshkol's house to tell him that the international pressure had increased and he had to stop the war as soon as possible at the request of the U.S. But Eshkol was watching the beauties of the Golan Heights with his commanders at the time. His wife gave him Eben's important message.
Eshkol, listen. Ivan wants you to stop the war. He can't take the pressure. He said, I can't hear you. What do you mean you can't hear me? I'm telling you in Ivan's exact words. He says, I can't hear you, I can't hear you. It's a bad line, it's a bad line.
But the prime minister did not consider the message and continued his work. Eben realized that Eshkol needed more time to advance on Syrian territory. It exactly happened, and they reached all their goals in Syria. Israeli ambassador to the UN received the text of the agreement. He had to read it aloud to the UN Security Council. This was the end of the war.
Israel accepts any proposal made by General Bull for the implementation of the Security Council ceasefire resolution and the arrangements for the supervision of the ceasefire.
Israel volunteered for peace because it had large areas of land to exchange. The Golan Heights from Syria, Old City of Jerusalem al-Quds, the West Bank from Jordan, as well as the Sinai Desert and Gaza from Egypt. The Israelis were ready to return the Golan Heights to Syria and the Sinai Desert to Egypt. But they had an important condition for peace, and that was acceptance and recognition of the independent state of Israel by the Arabs. Eben went to the United States to discuss Israel's offer with the Americans, but recognizing Israel was not something that Gamal Abdel Nasser and the rest of the Arabs wanted. The hero of the Egyptian people, who could neither make peace with Israel nor had the power to stop their military machine, had no choice but to resign. People were shouting, either Nasser or no one else, in Cairo. They were not satisfied with the resignation of Gamal Abdel Nasser. Nasser remained Egyptian president, but did not comply with the Soviet-US peace agreement. In September of 1967, Arab leaders gathered at the Khartoum summit and said, no peace with Israel, no negotiations with Israel, no recognition of Israel. Of course, the Arabs did not have other alternatives, and Israel did not return the occupied territories to them. On September the 28th, 1970, after the end of the emergency meeting of the Arab summit, Gamal Abdel Nasser felt a pain in his chest. He died the same night in front of Anwar Sadat's eyes. So the vice president became the president of Egypt, and many thoughts were running through his mind. 6 years had passed since the Israeli occupation of Sinai, and Egypt's third president dreamed of retaking a piece of land that had fallen to the Zionists during the Six-Day War. Sadat continued Nasser's strategy, so a new war was on the horizon. Sadat started the game with the Soviet Union. The U.S. supported Israel, and Egypt needed the support of the opposite pole. The Soviet Union played its trump card, shifting the balance of power in favor of Egypt. The Soviet Union prepared SAM advanced missiles, missiles that could challenge the security of Israeli jet fighters. Everything was ready for a new war. Egyptian SAM missiles were ready to target any Israeli element within 15 miles of the Suez Canal. Anwar al-Sadat was not alone in this war, and Syrian President Hafez al-Assad was with him. The attack had to take place in complete surprise. The promised day was chosen in the Allied front, and Syria from the east and Egypt from the west started attacking Israel, and the targets were again the Golan Heights and Sinai. Yom Kippur means Day of Atonement in Hebrew. And this day is one of the most important holidays in the Jewish calendar. Jews attend synagogue 4 times on Yom Kippur and pray. Egypt was aware of this. On October the 6th, 1973, as the Zionists were waking up to prepare for the festival, they were hit by surprise attacks on 2 fronts of Sinai and the Golan Heights, the same areas occupied by Israel in the Six-Day War in 1967. The first decision of the Israeli war room was to let the jet fighters counter the aggression, and the permission was in the hands of one person, Israel's fourth prime minister, Golda Meir. But she did not give the permission. Meir believed that if Israel wanted to attract international attention after the Six-Day War, it had to be recognized as a victim of Yom Kippur aggression. war had begun, the Egyptian commandos crossed the Suez Canal under their own heavy artillery fire and entered the Sinai Desert. At 4 p.m., the first Israeli fighters were allowed to fly, but as soon as they approached the Suez Canal, they were destroyed by SAM missiles. Inevitably, the Israeli tanks started attacking, but the Egyptians had thought about that too. The Sagar anti-tank missile made Sinai a graveyard for Israeli tanks. Sagar anti-tank guided missiles were again the result of Egyptian friendship with the Soviet Union.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
A successful prosecution of the WikiLeaks founder could empower the U.S. government to go after journalists for publishing classified information, says James Risen, author, in an article published under the heading, Biden administration's continued push for Julian Assange extradition is bad news for journalism. Stay tuned for the details, please. During the course of his career as the founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange has managed to anger both of America's major political parties. When WikiLeaks first began publishing leaked documents from the U.S. military and the State Department during the Obama administration, both Republican and Democratic politicians denounced Assange. Obama's Justice Department investigated him and very nearly indicted him under the Espionage Act. The Obama administration backed away from charging him only because they realized that doing so could lead to the prosecution of more conventional journalists and news organizations, including those like the New York Times, that collaborated with Assange to publish stories based on the documents given to WikiLeaks. During his 2016 campaign, Donald Trump regularly lauded WikiLeaks for publishing leaked documents from the Democratic Party, including from Hillary Clinton's campaign. The documents had been turned over to WikiLeaks by a front for intelligence, which had successfully hacked the Democrats. That led to intense Democratic anger against Assange and WikiLeaks, anger that has not been abated. But after Trump took office, his administration turned on Assange. The Trump Justice Department followed through with the indictment originally considered by the Obama administration. Trump refused to pardon Assange his final days in office, despite an intense lobbying campaign by Assange allies and press freedom advocates. Assange was left in a British prison. Now a third president must decide what to do with Assange, and the early signs do not look good for the WikiLeaks founder. The Biden Justice Department is expected to continue to try to extradite Assange from Britain so that he can face the charges brought by the Trump administration. In January, a British judge denied an extradition request from the United States, arguing that Assange's mental condition is so bad that he might kill himself in the American prison system. The judge set Friday as a deadline for an appeal for her extradition ruling by the U.S. Justice Department. The Justice Department has now said that it plans to file an appeal. Earlier this week, a group of press freedom organizations, including the Press Freedom Defense Fund, of which there are some directors, sent the letter to Justice Department asking that the case against Assange be dropped. The Press Freedom Defense Fund is a program of First Look Media, which also publishes The Intercept. But the Biden Justice Department's decision to continue the Trump administration's efforts to extradite Assange indicates that bipartisan fury at the WikiLeaks founder blinds leaders of both parties to what his prosecution could do to press freedom. The fact that Assange is so widely despised by the American political leadership and that so many U.S. officials from both parties would be happy to see him in an American prison may lead to a very bad law that could pose a serious threat to American journalism. If the Assange prosecution is successful, it will set a dangerous legal standard. It will open the door for the government to prosecute journalists for publishing classified information, even if doing so is in the public interest. The case against Assange has nothing to do with his role in the 2016 hack of the Democratic Party. The indictment is about the leak of secret military and State Department documents to WikiLeaks more than a decade ago and focuses on Assange's relationship with Chelsea Manning, the former Army intelligence analyst who was the source of the documents. The Trump Justice Department charged that Assange aided Manning in efforts to gain access to a U.S. military database. The charges against Assange were later broadened, and he was indicted under the Espionage Act. The Assange case could allow prosecutors to build criminal cases against journalists who obtain government secrets based on their interactions with their sources. Prosecutors can look at the electronic footprints of reporters and their sources and try to determine whether they can charge journalists under anti-hacking laws if they encourage their sources to give them secret information. Investigative reporters throughout the country could face criminal liability simply for meeting with sources and encouraging them to provide information. That would make it nearly impossible for reporters to aggressively cover the Pentagon, the CIA, or the National Security Agency, and ultimately imperil the American Republic. inside Israel.
There is an increase in social welfare cases across Israel. This is because there's dangerous levels of conditions and violence at home and in society. More people in Israel are seeking help than ever before. This includes hundreds of thousands of families. Many of them have sought help for the first time.
It's exceedingly much worse than last year. Our services are exponentially rising. The stats are in front of me. Our amount of food baskets that we give is from 3,500 a week to 4,500 a week. It's more than a 30% increase. There are hundreds of thousands of new poor that are seeking our services.
This is according to Organization of Directors of Social Affairs Offices in Local Authorities. This organization represents 150 welfare organizations across Israel. The report says that children are the most at risk. There has been an increase in social welfare cases. This is due to the significant number of families seeking help due to dangerous conditions and cases of violence at home. The coronavirus pandemic, along with a political deadlock and no budget, have brought hundreds of thousands of new families to social service departments. This is due to the economic and social distress they are facing. Hundreds of thousands of families have sought state help for the first time. Data also shows a 20% increase in children at risk. There's also a 26% spike in domestic violence. The numbers are from a group of directors of social affairs offices. They are known as the Organization of Directors of Social Affairs Offices in Local Authorities. The organization represents 150 welfare organizations across Israel. In a report it published in January, the organization claims that there is also a 21.5% rise in the number of calls relating to youth or young adults in distress. There is an affiliated rise in the number of young people threatening or attempting to commit suicide. The data relate to hundreds of thousands of citizens who have appealed for help and reflect not only a dramatic increase in the number of new applications, but also in the scope of issues involved. On social media, the conversation took a different turn. On Twitter, Gilad says, in Israel, the leading NGO that supports youth at risk published their numbers, and they are horrendous. Increase of 5 times numbers in youth cases, 4.8 times anxiety and depression, 2 times eating disorders, 5 times domestic violence, 2 times self-abuse, and today we launch another lockdown. Andre says he bets that nobody would be held accountable. Women's Voices says the number of complaints of domestic violence in Israel increased by 300% since March, attributed in part to the 2 coronavirus pandemic-induced closures and the subsequent economic crisis.
I'm self-employed and I haven't really worked in a year. So all of a sudden I'm also in a different kind of economic situation. The smart people do what they can, but I don't think there really is anybody that's... We were hit with a pandemic we didn't see coming. Nobody knew how to deal with it. And that includes the government. You know, we look to them, but they're just as clueless. Even today, after a year later, nobody's really sure what's really going on.
There's been a rise of about 68% of calls reporting domestic violence from Israeli homes to the resource centers and emergency centers. The problem is that we've actually seen a very big decline in elderly people calling, and there's a very high chance, according to various experts, that elderly people are being abused, but they are unable to call. And additionally, we've seen a rise of reports from women and children who are undergoing abuse. The problem is that many children cannot be seen in the schools by the teachers, so the only contact they have with them is through Skype or through Zoom, and that is why they are unable to really know about their condition and situation. There's no doubt that there's been a very high rise of violence against children in various homes, and larger numbers of children are suffering. The problem is that if a child goes to school, it's possible to possibly identify if he exhibits certain behavior that shows that he's been beaten at home, or may have scars, or the way he speaks or isolates himself. In the Zoom era, it's much harder. So while some teachers are somehow able to sense that something is wrong with some students, there's probably a much larger percentage of number of students who are being underreported or invisible for the violence that they're being on the receiving end of. And due to unemployment and high pressure and lack of adequate services, there's growing incidents of violence in many homes, and it's all the various after effects are also taking place, including homelessness and extreme violence. The Israeli government didn't really address the issue of violence in homes, although there's been a very large increase. So many of the organizations who are dealing with this have been overwhelmed. So there really hasn't been a new budget in the country. There's a lack of funding for organizations and for asylums and for schools. So due to all these reasons, there's been a massive underfunding, and this issue has been to a large degree unrecognized and underplayed by the Israeli government.
Since last year, there has been a significant increase in the number of children who urgently need shelter. Among the reasons for this are reports of suspected assault on minors, physically and sexually, and in towns that are considered economically strong. The number of young men and women hanging out in the streets without an educational framework has increased. The directors of social affairs offices demanded the regime establish emergency shelters for children of youth and men who live on the streets and do not have any family support, in the wake of the large number of young men who have been dismissed from their work and forced to leave their apartments. The situation is prevalent in all circles of Israeli society. In fact, in late 2020, the Women's International Zionist Organization, WIZO, a volunteer organization dedicated to social welfare that monitored the amount of calls to domestic violence hotlines, admitted that domestic violence in Israel has increased by 300%. Since the start of 2020, some 20 women were murdered by their spouse, with 18 of the murders having occurred after the coronavirus pandemic first broke out in Israel in March last year. The report also noted a 350% increase in the number of women asking for help in centers for the prevention and treatment of domestic violence. Of course, women are only another victim. According to the Organization of Directors of Social Affairs Offices in Local Authorities, the coronavirus pandemic has brought hundreds of thousands of new families to social service departments due to the economic distress they are facing. On social media, the conversation took a different turn. Kathy on Twitter says, "We do need to be prepared for a revolution. Who is going to lead and how do we gather and plan?" Rachel asks, how can we trust the regime to protect women when there is no consensus within our own justice system that domestic violence should be taken seriously? How can we expect women to believe that they are entitled to leave violent relationships when our courts tell them otherwise? Woman for Just says, so why did the right block an investigation of domestic violence and murder of women in Israel?
Because people in the end do what they want to do. And even now we're in a quarantine, but people are walking around. I can go wherever I want. So maybe in a sense, had they enforced it more, but you know, there's only so much. People have to take a personal responsibility also, is what I'm saying.
כנראה שהמוסדות שצריכים לקבל את הכסף, כל מיני מוסדות רווחה, כל מיני מקומות שצריכים לתמוך באנשים האלה, לא מקבלים תקציב, עמותות לא מקבלים תקציב, ובשביל זה אין להם כסף. האנשים האלה נהיו יותר מסכנים ממה שהיו.
That I have something to say about, because when I watch the news and I hear people talking about the government and vote for this one and elections, people are dying in the streets. I mean, not in the streets, but people are dying. We have much more important things to do than worrying about some Knesset member's seat. Yeah, I don't care about that. I mean, I'll vote, but I'm not going to invest my energy right now in this. We have more important things to do.
The Israeli government did not open up new centers for abused women. And although there's been a growing number of unemployed and homeless people in the streets, the Israeli government didn't create new centers or host people in new locations. All around the world, in multiple areas, in San Francisco, in Scotland, in London, the local governments and the national governments have been making very big and largely successful efforts in housing homeless people in different locations. The Israeli regime did not do this. It did not create new centers for people. It did not find new locations for people. And also, to a large degree, many Israelis did not want to host homeless people in many areas, whether hotels or Airbnb or other areas. So this did not happen. Right now, there are circumstances in which many fathers and husbands cannot provide for their family. And this, in a growing number of cases, is resulting in violence within the house. Additionally, many children and elderly living within the nuclear family and wives and mothers are encountering violence from their spouses or husbands. And the number of resources available and funding for solutions for this growing domestic violence is entirely inadequate. Additionally, due to the fact that Israel is currently undergoing its third lockdown, there's been the schools have been closed, as have most employment areas, and that is why there's been lack of proper education and a healthy environment for many students. In the last 10 to 15 years and longer, we've seen a gradual decline of various social services provided by the state to the citizens. And there's been a cutting of funds, so every year the budget has been getting smaller, and then in the last 2 years there was no budget altogether. But what is unique about this current COVID-19 situation is that the Israeli government is not creating new areas or hiring spaces where people could live and taking them off the streets. So the only thing they did is make some centers that were available already during the night. They made them also available during the day. but the number of homeless people is increasing, and there are many children in the streets, and the government is not doing anything about it, and people are growing up without any kind of guidance, which is a very dangerous and explosive situation. To begin with, Israel did not really allocate any new funds to the growing social problems that are taking place. Its only answer historically has been to provide more policing. But right now we have a situation with so many homeless people and so much violence within families and such a poor response from the country, you need to wonder what are they thinking and why aren't they taking care of their own citizens. So what Israel could have done differently was to find solutions for homeless people, find new areas where they could be housed, because the state owns a lot of territory, so they could have been housed there, and have more of a workforce that could visit families and check on children and elderly and see how they're doing on a one-to-one level of visiting.
So far, there is no plan by the regime to address the issues mentioned, but it is likely that even when the pandemic is over, there will be great pressure on social services due to post-traumatic effects. But what is really worrying is that these figures and numbers are huge for such a small entity such as Israel, and Israeli media is questioning whether or not Israel was ever prepared, and how the effects of the political deadlock have truly impacted Israelis, as politicians flex their political muscle while Israelis are forced to live out on the streets. Here are the news making the press in Israel. Haaretz, suicidal tendencies among school pupils up 42% this school year. Educational advisors reported having received tens of thousands of new requests for treatment by students seeking support for loneliness, distress, anxiety, and sexual abuse, according to a new report by Israel's National Council for the Child. YNET News. Israel's settler population in the occupied West Bank has grown at a far higher rate than the rest of Israel as a whole over the last 4 years, a pro-settler group said, a period that coincides with unprecedented acceptance of settlement activity from former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration. The report by West Bank Jewish Population Stats shows the settler population growing by around 13% since the start of 2017 to reach 475,481. During the same period, Israel's population grew by around 8% to reach nearly 9.3 million, according to the regime. Globes. Israel's Attorney General Avichai Mandelblit has decided to indict, subject to a hearing, former senior executives at Shikun & Binoy Holdings Limited, as well as the company itself, on suspicion of bribing public officials in Africa in order to win infrastructure tenders in Kenya and other countries, sources inform Globes. The Times of Israel. A bill stepping up enforcement of the coronavirus lockdown by doubling fines for violators passes final votes in the Knesset and will become law. The measure was the focus of fierce infighting among the parties in the coalition and had threatened to hold up a vote on extending the nationwide coronavirus lockdown.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, irib.org/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
All praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, especially the one remaining with Allah on earth. I greet the dear people of Qom and the Honorable Islamic Seminary of that city. Unfortunately, the circumstances for this year's annual meeting are like this, and I am deprived of seeing the enlightened faces of dear brothers from Qom. But this is life. It is one of the ups and downs. Life is full of such highs and lows, and we should tread the path of life. This will pass by Allah's favor. This incident too is a transient one, like all other bitter and sweet incidents in life. By Allah's favor and grace, we will be upon the paved road once again.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Today, I will discuss a few points about the important event and epic of 19th of Day. Also, I will raise a few points about some of the current issues that have occupied the attention of public opinion in the country. But before I enter into the main discussion, I wish to thank God and to thank the dear people of our country for their great and glorious movement on the day of martyrdom anniversary of our dear martyr, Shahid Soleimani. Shahid Soleimani and Shahid Abu Mahdi were revived in the voluntary movement of people from throughout the country. With that great popular movement, a fresh impetus was given to the country, one that could not be created with any directive and any edict. The movement originated from the people's emotions, hearts, insights, and motives. The same is true of the great and astonishing gathering organized in Baghdad and other cities of Iraq, with the purpose of commemorating Shahid Abu Mahdi, the outstanding Iraqi commander, and Shahid Soleimani, the dear guest of the Iraqi people. I sincerely thank all the brothers and sisters who participated in that ceremony in our country and in Iraq.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Around the World with Reporters.
February 2011. Emboldened by what was then hailed as the Arab Spring, people took to the streets in Bahrain. The crackdown that followed was brutal. Hospitals overflowed with the dead and injured, and the prisons filled up. On the 10th anniversary of the pro-democracy movement, the European Centre for Democracy and Human Rights held a conference. According to the speakers, the situation in Bahrain is worse now than before 2011, with hundreds of journalists, human rights defenders, and opposition figures still behind bars. The US and the UK have military bases in Bahrain. Human rights organizations say both are complicit in the monarchy's rights abuses by refusing to exert the influence they obviously have over the monarchy.
Bahrain is a political ally of the West. It's not some other, you know, this country that there is no kind of form of leverage or control over. In fact, the strength of US and British leverage on the regimes is so strong that it actually, I would say, coerce some of these regimes into entering the normalization deal with Israel that was perceived by, you know, across the board in Bahrain, you know, pro and anti-government people as the final act of betrayal.
One aspect of Bahrain's repressive tactics has received international attention: torture and sexual abuse used in prisons. And the UK's complicity is irrefutable. It trained Bahrain's police force, which carries out the torture, and the Special Investigations Unit, which continues to fail the victims. Some are on death row after giving false confessions under duress, and others live on with the horror playing before their eyes every day. We spoke to one of the victims.
It wasn't a prison, it was a morgue. You had no right to say you were innocent. If you did, they would start the torture, psychological torture. They would give us hallucination drugs. None of the guards were Bahraini. And they weren't normal. They were sick. They would make fun of us for missing our kids and family. Those who had kids were tortured the most. They weren't allowed to have visitors if they so much as drank water without permission. I think of those women. God help them.
Britain's top military brass were in Bahrain 5 days before the 2011 crackdown, in which 1,000 Saudi troops trained and equipped by the UK backed Bahrain's security forces. And since then, Britain has given Bahrain £6.5 million worth of technical assistance. Pressure is growing on Westminster to end the collusion, but Downing Street's damning record proves strategic interests trump human rights concerns every time. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Palestinian prisoners incarcerated in the Israeli military jail of Aufer started a partial strike by refusing to take their meals in protest against the escalated successive repression and assaults of the Israeli prison service. According to the Palestinian Prisoners Club Association, for almost 2 weeks, prisoners in Aufer jail have been subjected to harassment and repression, including surprise night raids and intensive unannounced cell search, strip searches, and being sprayed with poisonous gases, in addition to deliberate medical negligence.
A big number of administrative detainees are held in Aufer. What's going on there amounts to a crime being planned by the prison's officials. They want to bring the prisoners of Aufer to their knees. They have escalated their aggressive measures, such as carrying out several surprise searches of cells day and night.
Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are held in Aufer jail, including minors. Prisoners' advocacy groups say the inmates have sent a clear message to the prison administration that if these invasions and assaults that are against international laws and the Geneva Convention do not come to an end, then the prisoners will escalate their protest measures within the coming days.
Al-Asra, prisoners' lives are in danger because they don't intend to remain silent against this brutality. Prisoners now are planning other measures to protest their conditions, including refusal to talk with prison administrators and starting an open-ended hunger strike.
Reports say over 4,500 Palestinians are currently languishing in a number of Israeli jails, including hundreds being held without charge or trial under the illegal imprisonment known as administrative detention. Palestinian prisoners have always endured grievous oppression in Israeli jails. However, people in the occupied territories are worried today about their loved ones. They are concerned not only about recent brutal measures taken in the Israeli jail of Aufer, but also about the reports that more inmates there and in other jails have been tested positive for the coronavirus. Muna Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
This country has achieved an extraordinary feat, administering a total of 15 million jabs into the arms of some of the most vulnerable people in the country.
One of few successes in the UK government's handling of a pandemic that's left the country of about 67 million with a higher death toll and worse economic damage than many others. But with the situation improving, should the government open the country up for business? Members of the Prime Minister's own party are calling on him to commit to a timetable for scrapping the lockdown in the coming months. But the Prime Minister says he will only follow the evidence.
We've got to be very prudent, and what we want to see is progress that is cautious but irreversible.
Infections are falling but remain high, and former Prime Minister Tony Blair thinks the way to stop them soaring when the restrictions are eased is to issue vaccine passports, certificates that prove you have received the jab.
I think it's a step too far to have your movement controlled locally by some kind of passport or a piece of paper. I think that's way too far.
Some people cannot be vaccinated because of health reasons. It's just not safe for them. So to discriminate against those people and say, well, you're just not able to go to a coffee shop, go to a different country, that doesn't seem particularly just and fair.
On Monday, Health Secretary Matt Hancock insisted vaccine passports were not for domestic use.
But there are countries that are actively floating this idea and proposing it. And in that case, it will be important for people from the UK to be able to show whether or not they've been vaccinated in order to travel.
That seemed to resonate well with the people we spoke to.
I think it's a really good idea, you know. I think that so as we can travel is the main thing, really, what I'm sort of interested in, getting abroad for a bit of sun.
I think it's a good idea. I think if it means we can get back to doing summer holidays and travelling abroad, seeing family abroad, then I don't see why not.
Monday saw the launching of the UK's hotel quarantine regime, a new 10-day isolation for British residents returning from 33 COVID variant hotspots. Critics say the move is too little too late.
The UK is under an indefinite lockdown at the moment to curb the spread of the virus. Next week, the Prime Minister will unveil his so-called roadmap for the months ahead. But with his track record riddled with failures in handling the pandemic since it began, will Boris Johnson get it right this time? Saeed Purizab, London.